This is podcast number 150 for the well-educated mother's heart. Hi, I'm Marlene Peterson, and today I'm talking about Joan of Arc. I never tire of hearing the story of Joan of Arc. It's a reminder to me of how God can use the least of us to accomplish mighty works. Who else would choose a young peasant girl to free a nation? And had there been no France, there may not have been an America. I want to share a story that can be used to introduce her to your younger children. It leaves out the whole being burned at the stake thing, but will likely spark an interest to want to know more. The focus is on Joan as a child. It's from a book called Boys and Girls Who Became Famous by Amy Crews. But before I share that, I thought you might like a little background on my favorite Joan of Arc book written by Mark Twain called Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. Let me read from some glimpses I included in Stories of Great Writers in the Forgotten Classics series that talks about how Mark Twain came to write this book. This was when he was a young man. Coming home from the office one afternoon, he noticed a square of paper being swept along by the wind. He saw that it was printed, was interested professionally in seeing what it was like. He chased the flying scrap and overtook it. It was a leaf from some old history of Joan of Arc and pictured the hard lot of the maid in the Tower of Rouen, reviled and mistreated by her ruffian captors. There were some paragraphs of description, but the rest was pitiful dialogue. Sam had never heard of Joan before. He knew nothing of history. He was no reader. Orion was fond of books, and Pamela, even little Henry, had read more than Sam. But now, as he read, there awoke in him a deep feeling of pity and indignation, and with it a longing to know more of the tragic story. It was an interest that would last his life through, and in the course of time find expression in one of the rarest books ever written. The first result was that Sam began to read. He hunted up everything he could find on the subject of Joan, and from that went into French history in general. Indeed, into history of every kind. Samuel Clemens had suddenly become a reader, almost a student. He even began the study of languages, German and Latin, but was not able to go on for lack of time and teachers. Now let me share from a different book that picks up the story at a later time. As a man and an accomplished writer, he began to write the story of Joan of Arc while he was living in Florence, Italy. At Via Viviani, an old mansion outside of Florence, on the hill near Settignano, Mark Twain finished Tom Sawyer Abroad, also Pudd'nhead Wilson, and wrote the first half of a book that really had its beginning on the day when, an apprentice boy in Hannibal, he had found a stray leaf from the pathetic story of Joan of Arc. All his life she had been his idol, and he had meant some day to write of her. Now, in this weather-stained old palace, looking down on Florence, medieval and hazy, and across to the Villa Dotted Hills, he began one of the most beautiful stories ever written. The Personal Recollections of Joan of Arc. He wrote in the first person, assuming the character of Joan's secretary, Sir Louis de Conte, who in his old age is telling the great tale of the Maid of Orleans. It was Mark Twain's purpose this time to publish anonymously. Walking the floor one day at Viviani and smoking vigorously, he said to Mrs. Clemens and Susie, "I shall never be accepted seriously over my own signature. People always want to laugh over what I write and are disappointed if they don't find a joke in it. This is to be a serious book. It means more to me than anything else I have ever undertaken. I shall write it anonymously." So it was that the gentle Sieur de Conte took up the pen, and the tale of Joan was begun in the ancient garden of Viviani, a setting appropriate to its lovely form. He wrote rapidly once his plan was perfected and his material arranged. The reading of his youth and manhood was now recalled, not merely as reading, but as remembered reality. It was as if he were truly the old Sieur de Conte, saturated with memories, pouring out the tender, tragic tale. In 6 weeks he had written 100,000 words, remarkable progress at any time, the more so when we consider that some of the authorities he consulted were in a foreign tongue. He had always more or less kept up his study of French, begun so long ago on the river, and it stood him now in good stead. Still, it was never easy for him, and the multitude of notes that still exist along the margin of his French authorities show the magnitude of his work. Others of the family went down into the city almost daily, but he stayed in the still garden with Joan. Florence and its suburbs were full of delightful people, some of them old friends. There were luncheons, dinners, teas, dances, and the like always in progress, but he resisted most of these things, preferring to remain the quaint old Sieur de Conte, following again the banner of the Maid of Orleans, marshaling her twilight armies across his illumined page. And now I'll share the story as told in Boys and Girls Who Became Famous. Jeanne d'Arc, the peasant girl who died for her country. It was a fair, bright day of early summer in the year 1424, and the pleasant land of Lorraine lay green and fresh under blue skies and golden sunlight. In a meadow near the little village of Domremy, a group of country girls were minding their father's sheep. In that quiet place, the sheep needed very little watching, except when the cruel war that was rending France brought bands of rough soldiers to plunder the countryside. Then the church bell rang with quick, loud strokes, and the terrified children drove the sheep and pigs into the courtyard of the old disused castle that stood in a bend of the river, while the housewives gathered up their few treasures and followed. But on this day, all was peaceful. The bells were silent, except when they rang softly to mark the hour of prayer. The girls wandered over the meadow, picking handfuls of lovely summer flowers. Then they sat down on a bank where the meadow sweet grew tall behind them, and the one who had the most skillful fingers wove the flowers into a garland. "We will take it to the fairy's tree," said a brown-haired, sturdy maiden, whose name was Guillemette, "and hang it on a branch, and we will dance round the tree and drink some of the water from the fountain." "Which of us shall hang it there?" asked another. And then there were cries of, "Let me, let me," for the children of Domremy loved to hang garlands on the great beech which was called the fairy's tree. They thought that perhaps the little people might show themselves to the child who paid them this honor. "Let us run a race, and the one who wins shall take the garland," suggested Oviette, who was long-legged and swift in running, and the others agreed. So when the garland was finished, the girls ran laughing to the end of the field and prepared for their race. There was a dark, happy-faced maiden among them, tall and straight and full of health and vigor, and when the word was given to start, this girl sped along like a young greyhound, so that her laughing companions were soon left behind. "Jeanne, I saw you flying close to the earth," cried Oviette, as breathless they threw themselves down to rest, while the sheep who had moved uneasily as the racing figures passed them bent their heads once more to the sweet grass. "Jeanne," cried a voice from the side of the field, "you are to go home at once. Your mother needs you." Jeanne looked up quickly. A boy stood by the gate who was calling to her and waving his hand. She could not see his face very clearly. It was a village boy, perhaps one of her brothers. She got up at once and ran off. "Come back as soon as you can, Jeanne," called the others, and she answered merrily from the other end of the meadow where her swift feet had already carried her. Then she ran on to the comfortable cottage where lived Jacques d'Arc and his wife Isabella. "I'm come, mother," she cried, putting her face in at the door, but her mother, who was busy with household work, only looked up for a moment. "And why have you come?" she asked, a little sharply. "Leaving the sheep to stray as they will? Get you back, my maid. I want you not." So Jeanne went out again into the garden where the birds were singing and the scent of flowers made the air sweet. She was very happy, for she loved her home and all the country pleasures of the bright summer days, the sewing and pinning that her mother taught her, the sheep minding that was more play than work, the scouring and washing and baking. The thought of change had never come into her mind. She was content, and more than content, with things as they were. She danced gaily down the garden path, singing a little song, then stopped. A light so bright that it made the afternoon sunshine look pale filled the space before her, and in it moved shadowy forms. A voice, sweeter and kinder than any she had ever before, said, "Jean, my child, the King of Heaven speaks to you. He has great pity on his fair realm of France, and he bids you go forth and save her from her enemies. He bids you put on armor like a man and ride at the head of his army. But the time is not yet. Only be ready. Be a good girl and go often to church, and God will show you how to do his will." The voice ceased. The light faded. Jeanne stood by the garden gate, her face pale, her breath coming quickly. It had not been a dream. She was certain of that. She had seen and heard as plainly as she had ever seen and heard in her life. What did it mean? A girl of 13, poor, untaught, who could not even read, how could she save France? Jeanne loved her country and grieved sorely over the stories that came to Domremy of battles and slaughters, of towns destroyed and the countryside laid waste. But as was natural, she thought more of her own village, of the hills and the fields and the river she knew so well, than of the unknown lands that lay beyond. She to save France? It seemed to her as if it would have seemed to any girl of her age and her circumstance, a wild, even a monstrous thing. Yet she was not frightened. The voice had been kind and mild, with something in it that had roused her courage and her loyalty. She felt the stirring of a new spirit within her, and she went thoughtfully back to the meadow, not quite the same childish, untroubled Jeanne who had left it so blithely only a little while before. From that day, a new life began for her. She still played merrily with the other children of the village. She still sang as she scoured the pots or sat knitting in the doorway. But the feeling that a great charge had been laid upon her made her serious and less childlike. The voices came again and again, two or three times a week, and always they told her to be good and to prepare herself for the great work that God had willed she should do. The shadowy forms she had seen on the first afternoon grew clearer. One was a noble, mail-clad warrior whom she knew from the pictures she had seen to be Saint Michael. And there were two gracious and beautiful ladies who wore crowns upon their heads and flowing silken garments. These, because she heard them speak to each other, she had learned were St. Catherine and St. Margaret. Jeanne loved them with all her heart and longed to serve them. They told her to be good, and in her simple way she tried to obey them. She went often to church. She worked hard. She nursed the sick in the village and gave a helping hand wherever she could. Once, when some people from another village came fleeing to Domremy because they had been driven from their homes by a band of raiding soldiers, Jeanne gave up her bed to one of the poor fugitives. She had always been a favorite in the village because of her sweet temper and her happy face, but in these years when she was growing from a child into a maiden, everyone loved her and spoke well of her. She was quick and active and strong, and the voices she listened to did not make her dreamy or idle. She seemed to gain grace and dignity of bearing from her saintly guides. But she was still a peasant maid, downright in her speech and manners, ignorant of book learning, but with much sound common sense and native wit. The years went on, and gradually Jeanne became used to the thought of herself as the savior of France, though always she shrank in pain and horror from the thought of leaving her quiet home and taking so heavy a charge upon herself. But she was ready to do God's will, and when she thought of the plight of her unhappy country, she longed for the day when she might begin her work, even though she knew it would lead her swiftly to her death. She grew restless, looking for a way and finding none. The curé, to whom she told her secret in confession, had no encouragement to give her, and later when she confided in some village friends, they laughed and mocked at her. Her father, who perhaps had heard some rumors of the voice that spoke to her, dreamed that he saw her leave the village in company with some men at arms. "In that case," he said to his sons, "you must drown her, or I will." There was no one to whom she could look for help or sympathy. If she entered on this great mission, she must enter on it alone and unaided. By the fall of 1428, Jeanne believed that the voices were urging her to action. "Go to the Dauphin," they said, "and tell him you are sent by God to deliver him from his enemies and lead him to be crowned at Reims." Yet what could she do, a girl of 16, poor and without friends? Charles, the Dauphin, was at Chinon, 450 miles away, and much of the land that must be traveled to reach him was in the hands of the Duke of Burgundy, who was in league with the English. Jeanne did not expect a miracle by means of which she would be in some wonderful manner carried to Chinon. She was a plain, practical peasant girl, and her common sense told her that if she wished to make the journey, she must find herself a horse and a guide. So she set her wits to work. The nearest town held for the Dauphin was Vaucouleurs, 12 miles from Domremy. Its governor was Robert de Baudricourt, who was well known throughout the district. Jeanne had heard of him as a rough, blunt soldier, the last person to sympathize with a tale such as she had to tell him. Yet Baudricourt was, she saw clearly, the person to whom she must go. He could, if he would, send her on her way. The first thing to do, then, was to get to Vaucouleurs. Jeanne remembered that she had a cousin living at Little Bury, close by the town. This cousin had married a wheelwright named Lassois, who had always been friendly and kind to Jeanne. She begged him now to ask her to his house for a time, and he agreed, giving as a reason that his wife was ill and needed help. In May, Jeanne went to Littlebury, and from there she persuaded Lassois to go with her to Baudricourt at Vaucouleurs. Jeanne, in the plain red dress that the peasant girls of that district wore, and Lassois in his working man's garb, gained little attention from the men-at-arms who were gathered in the courtyard of the castle. When they asked to see the governor, they were met with laughter and rough jests. Jeanne wore herself calmly and steadfastly. She was not easily put out, and she was so intent on her purpose that she took little notice of jibes. Her good temper and her frank country ways won over the men, and at last she was brought before Baudricourt. She had come, she had told him, with a message. Voices had told her that she was to save France, and she must go to the Dauphin at Chinon. Would Baudricourt help her, and would he send to Charles and say, "Guard yourself well, and do not offer battle to your foes, for the Lord will send you succor by next mid-Lent." Baudricourt listened, almost as much astonished as he was amused, and when the maid had finished, he and the men around him laughed long and loudly. Here was a fine thing they had heard. This slip of a girl was proposing to take a hand in a war between two great kingdoms that had striven together for years, and neither, for all its power and all its valiant fighting men, had been able to tread the other down. And she was going to save France? Little wonder they laughed. "Go home," said the jovial Baudricourt, not unkindly. "Get back to your sewing and such like maid's work. Put all this nonsense out of your head and come not to me with such tales. Box her ears," he said, turning to Lassois, "and send her back to her father." And they all laughed again. Jeanne seemed scarcely to hear the laughter and ridicule. "Will you not send my message to the Dauphin?" she said. "It is a message from God, of whom the Dauphin holds his kingdom, though it is given by a poor girl, and God wills that he should have it." Baudricourt laughed louder than ever. "There would be scant reward for the bringer of that message, I trow," he said, "save to be soused in the moat as a saucy jester. Get you home, my girl." Jeanne and her companion were led out of the castle by the men-at-arms, while jibes and laughter and mocking cries followed them. But the girl held herself fearlessly and looked not the least cast down. She was doing the will of those who had sent her. They knew she had done her best, and they would help her when the right time came. She went home and took up her old life, working in the cottage and in the fields. She spoke openly now of her mission, and of the voices that were guiding her, and the people of Domremy, for the most part, believed that in Jean would be seen the fulfillment of the old prophecy they had all heard, that a maid should save France. Even her father no longer opposed her, and, little by little, it came to be understood in the village that when the right time came, she would go forth on her mission. There was, indeed, great need that some help should come to the unhappy country, for the English were pushing their way farther and farther southward. In July, a small force was sent against the district round about Vaucouleurs, and the people of Domremy left their homes and took refuge at Neufchâteau, 6 miles away. The force did little except lay waste tracts of the country, and after about a fortnight, the villagers returned to their roofless cottages and blackened fields. The war became more real and terrible to them after that, and they listened to Jean's message more eagerly. By October, the English had taken some of the smaller towns on the Loire and were besieging Orléans, and in January, Jean once more set out to Vaucouleurs. She went in sorrow, shrinking from the fate that was before her, hating the work she had to do. "I would sooner be torn by wild horses than do this thing, did not my lord command it," she said. She knew that she would never see her home again. She said many times that little more than a year of life was to be given her to do her work, but her faith in her mission never wavered, and she kept a brave heart and a cheerful face through all her trouble. Only on the last morning she wept as she looked on the old familiar places and the faces of her friends. She dared not say goodbye to Joviet, who had been her closest friend since they were tiny children together, and she stole away in the gray morning while the other girl was sleeping. She stayed with her cousin at Little Buret, and for 3 weeks she tried to persuade Baudricourt to send her to Chinon, but he still treated her message with derision. "I must be with the Dauphin by mid-Lent," she said, "though I wear my legs down to the knees. No one in the world can recover the kingdom of France, nor hath the Dauphin any succor save from myself, though I would liefer be sewing beside my poor mother, for this deed is not convenient to my station. Yet go I must, and this deed I must do because my lord wills it." At last her perseverance and her determination won her friends. The first was a young man-at-arms who knew her father and mother. He swore to go with her and help her in every way he could. Then the Duke of Lorraine heard of her and sent her to come to him. He believed her story and gave her money to help her on her way, and at length Baudricourt, too, came over to her side. Perhaps he thought that things were so bad, it was well to try any remedy, even so wild a one as this project of the maid's. Perhaps the faith people had in Jeanne moved him in her favor. He wrote to the Dauphin, telling him of the peasant girl and her mission, and he provided her with an escort of 2 men-at-arms and 2 servants. The people of Vaucouleurs subscribed to buy her a horse, and Baudricourt gave her a sword. She took the dress of a page because it was more convenient than her peasant girl's garb, and on February the 23rd, in the dusk of the evening, the party rode out towards Chinon. The rest of Jeanne's story belongs to the history of England and of France. It is not a story of which either nation can be proud, but for Jeanne, it is full of glory. She followed faithfully where her voices led her, through danger and cruel suffering, until the sad day when she died bravely in her country's cause.